much indeed for that very kind and generous and even slightly exaggerated introduction. I'm going to talk to you today about material that I've been working on for 20 years, and that will be summarized in a new book that will come out next spring, which is called Inequality: What Everyone Needs to Know. And I suggested to Oxford a second subtitle, which would be plus a few things that are not strictly necessary. But they wouldn't let me do that. This is work which is obviously on a topic that has been of very much in the news and of great concern to a great many people, particularly in this country, but everywhere in the world, for quite a few decades now, namely changes and increases in economic inequality, which we are all aware have been occurring. The difficulty, though, that I began to encounter when I first was drawn into examining this question was, this was back in the middle 1990s, was that the more you looked at the information on which political and policy arguments were being based, the less confidence that you had that the underlying measurements were sound and meaningful. And the difficulties were difficulties of conceptual foundation, difficulties of method, and the expense of gathering information. I want to talk a little bit very briefly, not to go into an enormous amount of technical detail, but to give you some feel for the diversity of approaches and some of the conceptual and methodological problems and issues that rose up that come to the fore. So when we talk about economic inequality, what is it that we mean? For a great many of us, it's inequality of wealth, which is to say the differences between what people own, what they've accumulated over time. That's the distinction between rich people and poor people, generally speaking, is that the rich people have a great deal and the poor people have very little. Wealth is, however, a very vague and practically unmeasured concept. We can measure financial wealth, what financial assets people own or don't own, and what they're worth in the marketplace at any given time. We can note the existence and roughly the value of housing wealth, what's the net equity people have in their homes, if they own them or if they don't. Although that, of course, is a somewhat notional concept, since most people do not buy and sell their houses every year. And there are other aspects of wealth which we don't measure at all. For example, the fact that quite a few of us, and I suspect even a few of the folks in this room, are the beneficiaries of the Social Security system, the Medicare system, which provide a contingent claim on a future stream of income or protection from losses, which certainly make a material difference to one's financial position. So wealth is a complex concept and one which is exceedingly difficult to pin down from a quantitative standpoint. Most economists work with something that is much more routine and is measured on an annual basis, which is income. But even there, one has to ask, income of what? Income of who? People earn income. So income can be measured at the level of a person, and often is. For example, if you're relying on tax statistics, what you're dealing with is tax returns. But in income translates into well-being through consumption and saving, and that occurs not at the personal level, but at the level of the household. And how much income, how well income translates into well-being depends upon how many people in the household have income and how many people in the household are drains on income, how many children and elderly, non-working people the household happens to be supporting. And those two things, if you measure the distributions, they can be, they're similar, but they can be quite distinct. Income can be measured in a number of different ways. We can be concerned about the income that people earn from the market, which is to say their wages and salaries and their capital gains and interest and dividends. We can be interested in the income that they earn not only from the market, but also from public pensions, and other forms of transfer, unemployment insurance and so forth. That's gross income. Or we can be interested in the income that they earn after taxes are taken out, direct taxes, income taxes. And again, depending on which of those things you're measuring, the concepts will be quite different. If you take, if you're interested in asking comparative questions, like is the United States economically more equal or more unequal than, let's say, countries in Europe or countries in the developing world, then you have to take account of the fact, first of all, that conceptually income may mean different things in different countries. Income in the United States is what the Internal Revenue Service tells you to report, I hope. Plus a few things you keep off the books, but you're not likely to tell a survey taker about them. But the tax authorities of other countries may have different rules, in fact, do have different rules. So income is not always the same concept in different countries. And of course, a great many countries, most of them, in fact, don't have effective income taxes. And so income measured there is something else entirely. It's what we tell the survey taker. And the survey takers may have their own rules for what they're asking. So in every stage of the game of measuring and comparing inequality, you have conceptual and measurement issues which have to be thought about very carefully. And I'll show you some of the implications of that in a little while. But for a lot of purposes also, it's the case that if you happen to be an economist and you're interested in not so much in, let's say, the comparative welfare of households, but in how the economy functions and relationships between, let's say, economic structure and performance. Questions like, is a society which is more egalitarian with strong trade unions and equalized wage structures more or less efficient? Does it have more or less unemployment? Does it grow more or less rapidly than an economy that operates on deregulated free market principles? Which is a good question that economists like to ask all the time. Then maybe income isn't the concept that you want, because households, after all, they change jobs. They're not always doing the same thing. And of course, they also have multiple sources of income. And maybe what you want is to measure what companies are paying, which is a different concept entirely. So what is the pay structures that are associated with jobs are part of the same flows, if you like, but organized in a quite different way from the income structures that households earn. Again, when I started working on this back in the 1990s, these questions were far from being sorted out amongst economists, and there was another very significant problem, which was that the available sources of information, even within the United States, but especially if you were trying to compare the United States with other countries, were quite sparse and erratic. All kinds of the available data sets, to the extent that there were any, took whatever information was available, jumbled them together, loaded them up on a spreadsheet, filled in some footnotes explaining what was being, sometimes explaining what was being measured, what was being reported, and then left it to the researcher to try and sort it out. And the result was, from a standpoint of a data analyst, extremely messy. Extremely messy, and the result of that was it was extremely hard to make useful and meaningful comparisons. Extremely hard. So what tended to happen, to be brutally honest about the literature, is that economists approached these questions with their own preconceptions of what might be driving inequality. And they looked at the data and they tended to see the pattern that they hoped to see. This was not a very edifying literature to read at that time. And it tended to turn around some rather conventional notions, particularly for the United States, which held, for example, that since technology is important to us, I suppose it is, that it must be, what changes in the income distribution must have to do with technology. That's the introduction of computers, personal computers, for example. And a kind of story was constructed around this to the effect that computers require lots of skill to use, and therefore employers who had jobs to offer that now required computer skills were going to tend to reward people who had higher levels of education, and this was going to cause a distortion in the wage structure, a change in the wage structure toward greater inequality, higher value of college education relative to other things. That's a rather standard story that took hold in the 1990s on the basis of extremely little actual evidence. And one of the things that I noticed when looking at the structure of pay in considerably more detail with techniques that I'll describe in a second, was that it didn't match up with the facts in any serious way. For example, the introduction of computers in the workplace took place after the recession of the early 1980s. The Apple IBM personal computer was introduced for the first time in 1981 and didn't really start selling until 83, 84 when the economy recovered, just for example. 1978, if you remember the Atari or the Apple II, these were toys. Not to say that there wasn't some computerization before that, but this is when the phenomenon is supposed to have really taken hold. But the changes in the wage structure occurred in the late 70s, early 1980s. They just don't match up with the phenomenon that was being advanced. But researchers, to be fair to them, didn't know that because they didn't have year-to-year data of the movement of inequality in the United States. And one can go through similar stories relating savings and investment behavior in developing countries, with one group of economists arguing that countries that had higher inequality would tend to grow more rapidly because they would save more, rich people save more than poor people, and another group arguing that egalitarian countries, pointing to Taiwan and Korea and other examples in Asia, which invested in education would have higher rates of growth for reasons of supposedly higher motivation for workers, this kind of thing. Arguments that went back and forth on very, very thin empirical basis. So, in order to make a contribution here, it became necessary to figure out a new way, a better way of measuring inequality in the historical record. And this became my credo, if you like, from my favorite philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, who wrote of Kepler that he undertook to draw a curve through the places of Mars. And that his greatest service to science was in impressing on men's minds that this was the thing to be done if they wished to improve astronomy. That they were not to content themselves with their inquiring whether one system of epicycles was better than another, but that they were to sit down to the figures and find out what the curve in truth was. And here was another problem. Almost all, in fact, all the records up to that time for measuring inequality were based upon taking surveys, one way or another. There was some tax record data, but mostly it was surveys. And to take a survey, you have to go out with survey takers, knock on people's doors, and ask them what their income was in a particular time period. And if you neglect to do this, you don't have any information. And you can't go back 5 years later and say, excuse me, sir, what was your income in 1997? The world is not constructed for people to keep records like that. By the way, households form and dissolve, and so you simply can't. If you don't have contemporaneous information, you have no information. And in most of the world, that was the case for most years.
You had very little continuing, steady information from those countries. So you needed something else. And the something else, let me see if I... that we decided to try to use was a very simple something else. The entire world, but especially a rich and data-rich country like the United States, is in the business of collecting information about economic activity. Income information, payroll information, employment information, from particular types of businesses in particular, or particular kinds of geographic jurisdictions, states, counties, precincts, and so forth in the United States, provinces, municipalities, and much of the rest of the world. And this data is regularly collected from by administrative agencies and sorted and published in charts and tables. True in China, true in Russia, true in India, true in all the countries, most of the countries of Africa, certainly true all throughout Europe and Latin America. And we thought, well, with that body of information, what we need is a calculating technique that can enable us to measure inequality. And it's really quite straightforward to do that if you, with a little bit of math and some ideas by a University of Chicago econometrician named Henri Teil, who was active in the 1960s and 1970s, and who pointed out this is really like measuring the information content in computer science. In fact, it's mathematically identical. And formulas are very simple. You can implement them on a spreadsheet. What you're doing is measuring the differences between the average incomes of groups, of categories. Industrial categories or geographic categories are sometimes the two blended together. And when you do that, you can get information that's quite consistent through time. And this is an example. This is a measure for the United States from 1969 to 2009. Of income reported in the tax records by county, 3,150 of them, and measured across counties. And actually, it resembles very closely the measure of inequality that the U.S. collects and reports from counties. So the two things, as you might expect and hope, are similar. It just shows you that the technique gives you a highly credible result. It rises, and this measure rises to a peak, starts here in the 1970s, rising. It rises to a peak in 2000, falls, and rises again to another peak around 2007. If you take a logarithm of the stock market, you get an almost perfect match to that. Right, so what's going on? What's going on in the United States, I would infer, from a simple inspection of the components that we use to build this series, this is our calculation on the series, is that incomes in the United States, inequality of incomes, is largely a function of who owns common corporate stocks and what their valuations are. And in particular, information technology stocks, NASDAQ in the 1990s up, peaked in 2000, came down again. Now what's going on there? People are getting capital gains, dividends, stock option realizations, and reporting those to the IRS. How do we know that that's information technology? Well, this is county information. And you can take out five counties from this series right here. You remove five counties from the series starting about here, about half of that peak goes away. If you remove 15, all of it goes away. The five that you have to remove to get half of it to go away, well, New York. Three counties in Northern California, Santa Clara, and San Francisco. King County, Washington, Seattle, Microsoft. So it becomes quite obvious what it is that you are capturing in the data. If you do a little map, which again one of my very talented students did, that shows you the differentials across counties. This is in the late 2000s. You get a different picture because actually the high income gains in the U.S. move around. All this talk about 1%, which is a kind of crude piece of populist rhetoric, frankly,
obscures the fact that the 1% in 1999 is not the same 1% in 2007, because you had a lot of real estate investors working in 2007 who weren't there in 1999. So instead, you have Northern California, but REAs is Northern California, but you also have a bunch of Southern California, and you have Florida, and some other places where you had real estate booms. Though, of course, you still have, you see that little radio tower at the top of the skyscraper there in SNL. Financial sector, which is driving the structure of the American economy, is always at the epicenter of rising incomes in boom times, but who it's distributing the credit to and who's making the incomes off of the activity changes from period to period. Okay. But I only wanted to talk a little bit about the United States. So I really want to talk about the world. And to do the world, we had to find a data set that covered a lot of countries in a systematic way. And that data set, actually, we eventually found it at the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Vienna, something called Industrial Statistics, and which simply reports income and employment, payroll and employment, for a specified set of industries, about 29 or 30 of them, for each of, well, they probably have about 200 countries on the list, so we were able to extract meaningful information from about 150 of them, 149. And then what we did was to use a statistical technique, a little model, to translate the raw measures into an income inequality measure that's kind of standard for economists. Once we had that, we had something nobody else had. And that was a worldwide data set going back to the early 1960s with a lot of annual information, different levels and changes for a lot of different countries that we could put together and try to squeeze out from the mass of information something meaningful. Something that gave you an understanding of how income inequality was changing in the world. And the best way to explore that kind of information is with maps. So what I'm going to show you here is a map of income inequality in the world such as we were able to measure it in the 1960s. This is decadal averages. So I don't give you 50 charts, I give you 5, decade by decade, with a color coding scheme that shows you from the cool blues are the low inequality regions, and the hot oranges and reds are the high inequality regions. And what do you see? Actually, you see something that you can capture at a glance, which is that the wealthy developed countries have less inequality than the torrid tropical countries in the lower stages of development. Clear. It's utterly transparent. And that tells you, of course, the lowest values are in Northern Europe, Eastern Europe, which was under communist regimes at that time, but also the social democracies, Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand. that gives you a story which has a very simple basis for understanding it, and that is that a rich country is by definition a country that has a large middle class. What else could it be? A middle class is a large body of people with some income, with a decent level of income. A poor country is, by definition, a country with a small number of rich people and a large number of very poor people. And that is a country that's going to have a lot of inequality. And that shows up in pay statistics, and it shows up in income statistics. As they proverbially say, it's not rocket science. But you do need to have a certain amount of information. Actually, going back to Kepler, it sort of is rocket science. But it helps to have some information to know where to set the rocket. And if you go through
the data by decade. As our coverage gets better, this is the 1970s, but also you begin to see changes. In the US, for example, 1970s, the period where inequality starts to rise. We get China into the data set, but it's a good communist country at the time, with very low inequality. On to the 1980s, and you can see inequality continues to rise. Looking at the data in a finer cut, one of the things you observe going on in the 1980s and 90s is that inequality rises in phases in different parts of the world. Very rapidly in Latin America, and what we have in Africa in the 70s, in the 80s rather, and then as you go into the 90s, you see the increases in Eastern Europe in particular, as of course the Soviet Union and its empire breaks up, and Russia comes into the data set, and inequality continues to rise, basically in most parts of the world, only holding steady or nearly steady in a few places in Northern Europe. And coming into the 2000s, you can see the world as it is roughly today. So what can we say about the measurement of inequality as we see it, which is that the world has become, as a whole, very much more like, at least in this respect, the less developed countries were in the 1960s. General systematic rise in inequality in most places, but with the differentials that we saw earlier in the beginning still in place. That is to say, countries like the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Australia have less increase in inequality, less inequality issues than the countries of Latin America and Africa.
Suggests, I think, that
if one is going to try to explain what happened, it's useful to begin by asking simple questions about what was happening in the world. In the world as a whole. And for example, that clarifies some questions. It's not possible to explain this phenomenon by the invention of personal computers. Personal computers, obviously, electronics have gotten around in the world over the years, but we're talking about a phenomenon that hits Latin America in the 1980s, at a time when that computerization was just coming into vogue in the richest countries. I don't think so, something else. We talk about the increase that obviously is occurring in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union. That's not hard to work out what the source of that is. We're looking at changes in the basic politics and the financial structure of the economic system. Moving from one model, which was a socialist communist model, to a capitalist model in which much larger inequalities are inherent and accepted. Is that not necessarily a bad thing in every case? But clearly it helps us to understand what's happening in the world. Similarly in China, and through the period of reforms, inequality rose. Everybody knows that. But it now shows up very clearly as part of a, let's say, global phenomenon. And for which the United States, of course, is not immune. If one goes back to the political ideology of the 50s and 60s, which was New Deal, Great Society, egalitarian, it's not surprising that inequality was stable or fell from the very equalizing experience of the Second World War until the late 1970s, when those political practices and policies fell out of fashion and were replaced by a much more laissez-faire oriented policy. Ronald Reagan took office in 1981. Combination of changes in policy and something else that I think is really crucially important, which is that the world as a whole shares an overlying system of financial governance. And that changed at crucial moments in the course of the story.
story.
In 1971, the system that had been devised by John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter Wright, White at Bretton Woods in 1944, put this man. That system was designed to make it possible for countries to pursue basically social democratic development policies. It was dismantled and replaced by floating exchange rates in 1973, which was much more, it was Milton Friedman's idea, much more free market oriented. It actually, that period produced declining inequalities in much of the world because there was a period of debt fueled growth in commodities that ended in 1980 to 2000 is a major increase in inequality. Why? Interest rates at 20%, debt crisis in Latin America and in Africa. The financial pressures are contributive to the collapse of the Soviet system, and eventually they spread also to Asia, where you have financial crises in the late 1990s. See, the movement of inequality tracks those phenomena very well, and even the exceptions are pretty well explained. India, for example, does not show rising inequality until the 1990s. Why is that? Because it was largely exempt in the 1980s from having any commercial bank debt, and so it was not affected by the world debt crisis. Same true of China, of course. And if you look at a country like Iran, you can see that the isolation of Iran from world finance that began in 1979 gave it a different trajectory in inequality than it had with many other countries in Japan. So that's the story that the data that we constructed tell. It's a story that effectively nobody else has, something I'm quite proud of, and it has been, it's been available now in consistently updated forms for a number of years, and it gets, it's on the web, anybody can use it, it's getting an increasing number of scholarly citations and recognition. But this slide is not perfectly worded. What I want to show you now is where our measures fit in the larger spectrum of measures of inequality that have been calculated by other, or computed by other economists around the world. And this is written over time. This is really remarkable work, although messy as hell to look at, that had been compiled by a little group of my students over the last 2 or 3 years. Can you make any sense of that chart?
No.
Great, that's the point. That's exactly the point. This is a compilation of measures of inequality in the United States. Right? Some of them from the Congressional Budget Office, some of them from the Luxembourg Income Study, some of them from the current population survey. The green ones are this concept of market income, which is what markets give you without taking account of Social Security. The blue is gross income, which includes Social Security. The red is disposable income, which takes out income taxes. So, nice pattern. Market income is very unequal. Gross income, a good deal less so. Net income, still more equal. All of them rising slightly. The black, dark black line in the middle is our measure. Our measure is pretty good, tracks the gross income, at least some of the gross income measures, quite well up until the 1980s and the 1990s, and then loses it because we don't pick up the stock market, which is a deficiency of what we do, but the United States is the only country that it matters.
Something to be aware of. If one looks at the wealthy countries of the world, there's Canada, there are too many of these, but you can see the data are a mess in country after country, and so there was actually some value, I would argue, in having a single consistent measure whose value is comparative, its usefulness is that it's comparative, you know that it's computed in a consistent way across all of these countries. And in almost all of the cases, particularly the wealthy countries, this little black line, this is the Netherlands,
comes in right in the middle, above the disposable income, below the market income, is where you hope you would find it. So that's my argument for saying that really what we did, although it was quick, dirty, cheap, and highly unconventional, actually does a pretty good job of coming up with something that's credible for comparative studies. And if you were not careful and were simply comparing any of these other measures with other measures for other countries, who knows what you would have or what conclusions you would be able to draw, because they're simply not designed with the thought that they should be comparable in mind. There's the UK. You can see in almost every case, in fact, in every case in the rich countries, we are pretty much on target where we want to be. There's a second set of countries that have a different set of, a different pattern, and that I've only found out about, although it's not hard to understand, when we began to do this kind of work of looking at the data and seeing what other people had, in fact, recorded as income inequality. This is the transition economies. For example, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic. And you actually get pretty good long runs of data for a lot of these countries. The countries that shifted from communism in the late 1980s, early 1990s. There's Hungary and there's Poland. Poland is a nice example.
And what do you see? For one thing, these countries are much more egalitarian, practically all measures, than the countries of the non-communist West. Don't surprise, they're communist in this period. That's part of what being communist meant. But the other thing, which continues into the post-communist period, is that the measures of market income, well, market income is a little different, but gross income and net income aren't very different. They're very similar. So there isn't a redistribution through the tax system, which again, not surprising. Most communist countries didn't impose big income taxes. They imposed value-added taxes and sales taxes, which are not picked up here. And so they have more equal wage structures, but less redistribution through the tax system than we do, than Canada does, and Western Europe does. Very interesting, I think.
Legacy, if you like, of their historical experience. There's Russia. You can see, of course, the catastrophic,
just dramatic increases in inequality, which, of course, everybody remarked upon at the time. In the early 1990s, as the Soviet Union collapsed, and you can also see the data in the
post-Soviet period is really quite erratic, but it shows very much higher levels of inequality. There's Ukraine, really quite good. And then there's a third category, which is developing countries. There's Argentina, for example. In most of these cases, we have, our measures are pretty good. In most of them, we're sometimes low for reasons that are idiosyncratic, and I won't go into that in great detail. But here again, these are high inequality countries by and large, but also ones that do very little redistribution through the transfer and tax systems. And so the different measures tend to be quite, there's Mexico, what a mess, quite jumbled up, and it's for understandable reasons. You don't see the difference.
If you look at the whole pattern of average values of these coefficients and our data through this period, clear break in the early 1980s, big increase which goes on to 2000. There's a this jumping up here has the stabilizing here has to do with the fact that adding in the East European countries when they come into existence in the 1990s or the post-Soviet countries reduces the total.
So that's just a detail. You can do the same work with other sources of data, national data, for example. This is data from the States, this is from Europe, from China, which we've been harvesting since the
early 1990s, actually. And it shows you some very interesting things. This is measurements across different economic sectors. This is measurements across the provinces of China. And what do you observe? China has had greatly increasing inequality through most of the period up until the early 2000s, but then at the regional level, it peaks and starts coming down. And in 2008, the industrial level, it peaks and starts coming down. And if you take the blue line, which is putting everything together, the peak is around 2008, maybe, 2007. And then Chinese inequality starts to decline.
That's the first evidence, by the way, that anybody ever had that Chinese inequality might have peaked. Up until the point that we made these calculations, the whole story on China was that inequality was just going on and up and up.
And we say, no, maybe not.
Why not? A simple mechanical reason, which came on the regional basis. The initial rise in inequality in China is a function of the fact that Guangdong province got rich first, then the city of Shanghai, and then the city of Beijing. That's where the incomes went. Did the open door policy and the manufacturing development went into what had previously been a poor, rural, frontier province, Guangdong? Incomes went up there. When Shanghai starts competing to be one of the great financial centers of the world, and trading centers, incomes go up. And Beijing, has been there? These are places that are unreal in the degree of urban development and the kinds of incomes that you see. The Olympics, of course, fueled a huge construction boom. Now, though, after the Olympics, the Chinese development spread out. Other provinces, Shenzhen, Fujian, Tianjin, and so forth, are sharing in the rise in incomes. And as that happens, the overall inequality measure peaks, because the differences between the top and the bottom are being filled in the middle. That's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just something you can understand what's happening in the data. If you go and do some work, I call those the Kuznets and the Schumpeter transitions. And do the same thing with Europe, with European data. The European Union is quite good at getting at compiling data across Europe. And one of the interesting things is that it makes it possible to calculate inequality measures for Europe as a whole, as a continent. You will notice, if you've ever looked at this, that there are measures of inequality comparing the United States with Europe. Lots of people do this, but what they almost always mean is the United States with Germany, or the United States with Denmark, or the United States with Italy or Spain, country by country comparisons. But the average income difference between Poland and Germany is enormous. It's much bigger than the average difference between New York and Texas. Much. 30-40% instead of 10. And so if you take account of that, European inequality is much higher than it would appear to be on a country-by-country basis. And Europe can appear to be more unequal than the United States is on a reasonable calculation. But also you can see what the source of the inequality is in Europe. The biggest contributors, so this is a kind of particular analytical graph, but you look this is the zero line, but the bar is above the zero line for the who's really winning in this picture. This is finance. This is the income of the bankers. Yeah, because bankers, there are no such thing as poor bankers, right? They drive the inequality statistics. And notice how it comes down a bit after the great financial crisis. Another interesting fact. Well, yeah, it's across six sectors. You can do it across 250 regions that they have in the data. And you can do the same exercise. Here's the zero line. These are the richer regions. These are the poorer ones. These are two places in Europe that contribute a lot to the measure of inequality in Europe and a lot to the change after the crisis. City of Paris and City of London. By buying real estate in either one. You will see. It's just concentration of incomes and concentration of wealth. Okay. I'm going to say one other thing. I've stretched your patience, I'm sure. But something quite interesting. These are looking at sort of underlying raw data. And they're using another set of maps that are calculated over six-year intervals. And instead of being levels, which the previous set were, I've now color-coded them by rates of change. And so you're going to see red when the inequality is going up and blue when it's coming down. This is under the underlying pay data, so it's not quite incomes. But it will tell you something quite interesting about the world, which we're working on now. So the period of the 60s, inequality was declining in much of the world. You can see that in the data. In the 70s and 80s, so we move into the 80s, boom, you get these big changes as inequality goes up, first in the debt crisis countries, ultimately in the East European Soviet region, and in Asia. And then you come into the 1990s and 2000s, and guess what? Let's see if that's the last one. It peaks. In a lot of places, actually, we have a period of which some of these measures of pay data, which tend to be a pretty good precursor of what's happening to incomes, are now coming down again. And not just, I showed you China, not just China, but I can see it in India, I can see it in Russia, I can see it in parts of Western Europe, I can see it in Canada. The U.S. is just very close to stable in this later period. Which raises an interesting question. I don't know how many of you, surely a fair fraction of you, have acquired that magnificent bookstock that is Thomas Piketty's Capital. 770 pages, of which the average reader has read 3%, according to Kendall.
The theme of Professor Piketty's analysis is that in capitalist societies, inequality always goes up. And we're heading straight back to the 19th century, so get out your Balzac, get out your Dickens, even though the prospect sickens. Anyway,
brother,
here we go again.
Our data, which are far more comprehensive and, I would argue, far more neutral in the way they're calculated than Piketty's data that I looked at, suggests something quite different. It suggests that what particularly happened in the world was a rise of inequality. Oops. In a particular period, the 1990s and 80s and 90s, which peaked in 2000 and stabilized. And the inequality levels are much higher than they were 40 years ago, but they aren't going up in much of the world today. Time will tell whether that continues to be the pattern. I have no insight into the future. But I do think it is helpful to try and come up with some clarity about what's going on in the world, to have some clear-cut insight into what actually did happen in the past. And that's the contribution that we've been trying to make, and that's what we think we've contributed to an understanding of inequality in America and the world. Thank you very much.